got there. You're home on the, what is it, the 13th day of August, something like that, 1969, the day the astronauts are being honored in New York City, to talk with you about some of your reminiscences of things in Madison that have happened that we don't know about or have forgotten about, and in particular, the things that concern the Historical Society. This, I think you know more about than almost anyone else in Madison, and particularly about the doll exhibit that you are the mother of in every respect, and have carried, nurtured, and carried on up to this point, about which we have very little in writing or in official records about in our archives. So I'm going to turn and ask you to think about that. Well, Grace Minor, what do you want to tell us about the doll exhibit?
Well, I have been very much interested in this doll exhibit in the doll room from the time that we took over the Historical Society house and paid its mortgage, and I was president. I had collected for a number of years many little dolls and furniture and everything that went with them, especially fine little costumes for the dolls. But the group was really started by Miss Elizabeth Nash, who had collected a big collection of dolls from all over the world. And mostly for the costumes. And that is what started us. We didn't have anything to fill up the rest of the shelves, so we put in choice pieces of dolls' furniture and some special dolls we had. Mrs. Pratt had collected some English dolls, supposed to be dancing dolls that you could wind up, and they'd sort of groan and then stop their dancing right away, but we still have them in the collection. And many choice dolls have been added each year. Among them, we have a Buddhist doll, we have a doll from Burma, we have Miss Mary Griswold's doll that was 100 years old when she presented it to the society. We have a doll that Catherine Whedon Darling gave to us, Sophia, that was given to her when she was just a little child. And we have now a doll, Elizabeth, given by the grandchildren of Mrs. Philemon Scranton. It is one of our choicest dolls now, because it has a trunk full of handmade clothes that are so beautiful to look at. Each stitch is by hand. I could tell you and describe so many dolls. The wax dolls came first, and if the child left a wax doll out in the sun, it would be all disfigured and her heart would be broken. So wax dolls didn't last very long. And then came the bisque dolls, after a lot of china dolls were sent over from England. We have a very choice collection of the china heads and cloth bodies. And then, after the bisque dolls came, and now, the plastic dolls and the natural dolls made to make their faces look more like babies. And we have all in all a collection of 200 dolls and very beautiful garments all together.
I want to ask you about the calico. Aren't there any dolls made out of cloth? I remember the old colonel and his wife from the old Civil War days that are still talking about their reminiscences. They're made of cloth, are they not?
Yes. We haven't finished the character dolls yet, because we're just coming to Johnny Appleseed. Mm. And the Colonel and his wife from the South, presented by Miss Ernest Godman, they're all dried apple faces and attract a great deal of attention because they look like tired out old people, which they were. The Colonel and his wife should always be mentioned and looked at because he crosses his legs and takes hold of her hand and tells her the same old stories of the Civil War that they never really lost, he said. And she looks so bored and tired because she's heard that story for years and years. Those two dolls attract a great deal of attention. And we have, of all the dolls that stand out the most, are some beautiful ones that have been given us by the Bushnells years ago, presented to Mrs. Kendall when she was a child and presented by her daughter, Alice Bushnell. And we go all the way through the room. There's a long story to tell about each little doll there or larger. And we have dolls furniture made in the carpenter shops here because Madison, as a shipbuilding town, had a great interest for the boys who went in early and learned to whittle and make models and many things. We have toy animals all whittled out. We have the greatest interest for the boys as well as the girls in this room. We have a model of the first train that ever went through Madison in 1856. And many things, little chests and bureaus and tables and beds and cradles that will interest any boy who wants to make something for his sister. This doll room is full of treasures from tea sets that have been very unusual, presented by Mrs. Alice Jones when she was hostess in the house. We have many things that Mrs. Jones started here, and this doll room was a joy to her. We have homemade quilts. We have crocheted affairs of all kinds of the now about 100 years ago, a good many of them.
Well, that's certainly fascinating. You know, I had not realized the sources from which the gifts have come, by the number of people that have contributed. I think probably there is no one room that has more contributors represented than our doll room has, although it's possible some of the little artifacts in the old kitchen came from many different sources. But it's rather interesting that this is one of the few rooms where we have gladly accepted gifts from sources that where they originated outside of Madison. On the pool, you know, that we try to keep the society to represent the things that originated in and grew out of Madison, rather than make it a world collection of any subject whatsoever. We never could possibly expect to make a respectable museum if we are trying to make ourselves into a metropolitan or whatnot. But here, we most of our things are local in character, with some fine exceptions, like the china that came from China by way of the steamships, the sailing vessels, and so on. But I think it's quite proper that our dolls should have come from many different countries and not be exclusively Madison products.
I tell these children who come in great hordes from the schools that I want them to remember that this is not a museum, it's a typical New England home. When the schooners were being built here at the shore, and when many, many people were bringing choice things back to Madison from Madison people. And this is the children's hour and the children's building that they themselves must take a special part in remembering that the mortgage was paid on this house and it's a heritage of theirs. Each child can find something from some grandfather or grandmother or somebody that's come to them from back and bring it to this society. We have a little doll carriage that Mrs. Myron Hall had when she was a small child, way back in the early 1800s. We have little bits of beds with the choicest kind of blankets on and everything to attract these children. But more than anything else, I want them to remember that this is their heritage. And they must take care of it and be choice of the things and add to them as the years go on.
So that's a very fine message that you give our children, and I know how much they love it and will remember their visit to your charming doll room at the head of the stairs on the second floor. The first thing you see when you climb the stairs, and it's proper that it should be the first thing. Well, what are some of the other things that you're doing now, Ms. Montgomery?
Well, in connection with the doll room, we have a very choice little hair trunk. A small size, it would be, given by Mrs. Mary Scranton Everett, who was such a vital part of our historical society all through its life. And I am filling it with documents and old photographs. I'm anxious to get the baby pictures or childhood pictures of as many as I can of the founders and the people important to the historical society. I have a baby picture of Kendall Redfield, who happened to be born on my 21st birthday, and his mother, and the picture of the Scranton girls, who were a vital part of Madison for so many years. And I have pictures of Ward Scranton and his little sister and cousin. I have many pictures of people that I'll tell you about if you come to the society and meet me upstairs in the doll room. This collection is going to grow. I have pictures of the launching of the old ships, the crowd gathered around at that time. And I want this room to be just a special room for the boys and girls. Sometimes the boys look in the door and say, "Oh, dolls." And then when they look further along, they find we have model of the first engine, wood-burning engine, that took the train through Madison in 1856. We have a copy of the first Ford that went strutting through here in Madison, driven by Mr. Wilson B. Cole. We have so many things that the boys have made and presented to their little sisters from the little tool rooms around the town. We have things that you will enjoy thinking about and learning more about if you come to the doll room.
It's good for you. That's a splendid thing to be doing. I'll have some contributions to make to that collection because I have inherited an album of photographs, mostly daguerreotypes, of my grandmother, Scranton, her cousin, who's also a Scranton grandmother, both born in Madison and married in Madison. At least no one of them married in Madison. But all their relations and their children, it isn't something children would be interested in themselves. It seems to me that it would be a proper place to put this when it's properly brought together and identified and described and put in a particular spot, I think it might be a proper contribution.
Indeed, it would be.
Well, we look out on here across Scotland Avenue and across the street. Whose yard do I see?
This is the pasture belonging to Mr. Smith next door.
He's the oil man?
Yes, the oil man. He has many sheep there. And one donkey that's lived there for years and years. It's just a pastoral scene that people love to come and look at, and the children stop going by to see it.
Don't see many donkeys anymore.
Well, he has a... Mr. Smith says, don't call that a donkey or a burro. It's just nothing in the world but an old-fashioned Texas jackass.
Well, that's quite a reputation to maintain, isn't it?
If you have questions to ask me, I'd be glad to answer them as far as I know. But
we have lost two of our most loved and valuable members of the society lately. They're both dear friends of yours, I know, as they were of mine, me. Of course, there's Mary Scranton Everett's. Carl Sonic's son. Those two men, people were invaluable parts of the society. No one can ever end telling the things that Carl Sonicson did for other people out of the goodness of his heart, with his able hands and his imagination and his patience. He was an amazing person, and one of my dearest colleagues and friends in the early days when I came back to live in Madison from 1958. But what is your outstanding feeling about these two people? I know it's superlatives have got to come.
That would take a special book that I would like to put up. I would put the name of Mr. Carl Sonicson in as being the handiest man and the best-natured man that I had ever had around to work with. He could fix up any piece of furniture, he'd do anything you thought of, and we missed him so very, very much. But to add to that list would be so many, Mr. Philip Platt among them. Someday we'll have to write what he has done, but it would take more than one volume because he followed his mother in taking a great interest in the Historical Society. So many people have been intensely interested in the Society and have carried it on, but they don't want publicity. They just want to have this a big success and to go on.
But the problem is to turn over this leadership and this responsibility to those that follow us, because we are all going to pass on, and we are the old-timers. How are we going to get the next generation and the one after that really deeply involved in the society and work for it the way we have? That's our challenge, and I think our school, our Junior Historical Society, is doing a magnificent job in arousing and planting the seed of interest for the future in these children.
One of the people we must not forget is Miss Elizabeth Roby, who has shown such a deep interest in the Junior Historical Society, and they meet regularly, and Mrs. Dallmeyer helps so many helpers that are not mentioned. But Miss Roby has carried these children on and started the meetings in the big house. They didn't realize there was such a place in town until the Junior Society was started, and is very active more and more now and taking a deeper interest in their own historical society, not a museum.
I'd like to mention several things that Carl Sonicson did with me during these past 8 or 9 years. This was the type of thing that he would do. Well, the Lee Academy had no flagpole.
He had an old flagpole that he knew that he could get from somebody, and he went and got the several sections of this metal flagpole. He brought them down, and together we dug a hole in front of the Lee Academy, made a concrete base, and together we erected this flagpole, which stands there now proudly, and the flag is raised there every morning and night, taking it down at night. Now, who would have done that? As a volunteer, if we'd had it done by the Field and Company, our very reputable and valuable construction builders, they would have done it. But what would it have cost? Probably more than we could afford. Then came came the question of the corn crib. The corn crib, which now stands back of the Alice House, was on the property of Cyrano Scranton, the son of Charles Woolsey Scranton, the son of William Scranton, William Dowd Scranton, and who now, which is now, after the death of Mrs. the last Scranton to occupy that was Minnie Scranton, who was the wife of Ernest Conover. She lived in it for a while, as I recall, and on her death, no, it was Alice Milligan Scranton, Alice Scranton Milligan, who lived in it till her death, and she left it to her niece and her nephew, Helen Coase and her brother. It was sold to the bank, our First Federal Savings and Loan Association. I begged the officers of the bank to give us that the society, that corn crib, which had no real purpose to stay longer on the property back of the house. And they allowed us to do so. And Carl Sonicson got a friend of his to bring his trailer, and together we got it on this trailer and brought it over to down the. We had to follow the traffic rules, of course, and go west on the main Boston Road on the south side, and turn around the corner and start east on the main Boston Road. So we got to our Alice House, and then take it in over the sidewalk and down behind the shed and back and put it in position, which we are prepared. We had got the stones in position for, and it was all done. And then we painted it, and we lined the inside of it with cellophane so it would keep the rain out. All these things were done voluntarily by Carl Sonicson, with much help some of us could give him. Another example would be finding that Mr. Chambers had an old chicken house up on New Road, back of the railroad tracks, just over the parallel with Scotland Road. On this new road, he had this house which he had reconditioned, was about to sell, and he wanted to tear down this chicken house, which he turned over to the four old patriarchs of the society. One of them was Carl Sonicson, Ed Reeves, Frank Boyd, and myself. We are all averaged over 70, and some of us were nearer 80. But we got up on this building and took it apart as best we could, and then we got our own trucks and wagons to carry it over to the Historical Society, Alice House, and then but mostly the Carl's leadership and the skill, we laid the foundations and the stones and erected a building which was about the usual same width as the other part of the building, but was about 18 or 20 feet longer, extending the shed, as we called it, to the north, making a third section of about 20 feet. This was the roofing and the windows and the doors and the painting, and the whole thing was done by our own old men and our own volunteer services, which we never would have been able to have done if we had to pay a building construction organization to do. These are just examples of how Carl was the motivating force and the leader in these things. But now we have no one that can replace him. There's no one that has the time or the interest or the ability or the skill and the will to do these things anymore.
Mr. Wheaton had another father who bought it from Lawrence Bushnell. He was a new steel on the roof. Now, he was from up the river. Well, this is up the river, from up the pond.
The Wheaton Pond?
Yeah.
Now, this, where was this street? Oh, that's a real building. Gosh, that's a hell of
a... That was the storehouse where he air-dried all his lumber.
And here's the stockpile where he finished lumber.
No, I'll tell you what that is. That is the remains... Here's Clayton coming in now. I've got to get him a cucumber, and then I'll come back and talk to you.
All right. I don't know where this Clayton Pond is. Can you describe exactly where it is? How do you get there from here?
Yeah, I got there from here.
I've heard that remark before.
We were trying to tell Clayton where your father's pond was. It's off Pond Road.
You know where Art Syme and Lil lived?
Lived? I know, on 79, yes.
Well, that brook starts in the swamp between Horse Pond Road and 79, just below the pines.
Yeah.
It trickles down on the east side of the road.
How does it get across Horse Pond Road?
It trickles down the east side of 79, about 500 yards below the pines. Then it crosses over.
Under the road or over it?
Under the road. Into what is known as Muddy Swamp that I used to own.
Oh.
And it runs down and divides my property, what was my property, from Ben Houston's. That old, old dilapidated house just below the pines. Until it gets down to where Lil Syme lives. Ooh. Then it comes back under the road again by Martin Klein's chicken farm.
Oh, Lord.
You know where that big white chicken farm is? Yeah. Well, that's it.
That's the one that's opposite the flower center,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. That's his north line, used to belong to Lou Dowd, where Charlie Shorter lives, and now then Raymond Lewis has since been sold. It comes through and it cuts the corner of Lil's yard. Art had a little pond about as big as this kitchen dug out there. Then it runs through the fence, parallels the fence till it comes down to Green Hill Road, goes under Green Hill Road, about 500 feet from the intersection, Green Hill and 79. Runs down through
east,
back
east.
Of...
Running east.
Running south then. It runs down the back of... Helen Watson's sister. Gene Kaiser. All through Gene Kaiser's property. And then down through into what belongs to Alice Kelsey, the sand pit.
No.
Comes in back of the Dutch Hall and Johnny Goodale. It ran into what was Art Schumann's ice pond up in Wildcat where the new development is. Runs down back of Johnny Goodale's, parallel with Horse Pond Road, and comes under Horse Pond Road at the foot of that hill where you go down by Johnny Goodale's. Then it cuts right straight across, and about 100 yards down is the entrance to Wheaton's Pond, the upper end of it.
How big a pond is it, you think? How many acres?
I don't know. There's 28 acres in the whole thing, but I would say the pond was maybe a couple of acres.
Is it people skate on it now at all? Can it forever freeze?
The present owner did not like anyone to skate there because he was afraid somebody might get drowned and he'd be loud. But
what a world.
The pond was originally the sawmill pond at Arthur Scranton's ice house.
I remember Arthur Scranton bringing his ice around in his ice wagon.
Well, he had a big ice house on Hummer's Pond on Lover's Lane.
He did, too.
And he had two ice houses up there.
Mm.
Dad sold the pond and that ice property to Arthur Scranton and gave him a 50-foot right-of-way on the south side of the pond. Because...
And that's where the sawmill there at the time?
Yeah, the sawmill. Look at that picture you have there.
That was already there?
Oh, yeah, sure.
So how did your father have right to build that sawmill on the pond? Did he own it then?
His father had it before he did, and the back of the thing said that my grandfather, William, bought it from Lord Bushnell.
Mm.
And he had flowage rights.
Flowage?
Flowage rights.
Flowage.
Flowage rights over Alvo Leach Meadow, so that if he wanted to get extra waterhead, he could raise the dam, and he could flow over Alvo's fresh meadow, clear up to the Horse Pond Road.
How much head do those there was to operate that straw mill? Did they have a water wheel?
Oh, sure, he had two. He had a big one that he used for sawing big logs outside, and a small one that he used for running the small machinery inside the shop.
That's like the house that had the big hole in the door for the big cat,
yeah,
and the little hole for the little cat.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, it was entirely separate. The water came from the same place.
Mm.
But if you open the gate to the big wheel, it ran the 4-foot saw that sawed big logs that 3-4 horses had to drag in.
Mm.
And then the little wheel was under a separate control. The water came down the same chute, went this way for the big wheel and that way for the little wheel. Then the water went into what we call the wasteway ditch, and that and the overflow came together and ran into the Hammonasset River just below the place they call Riverside, where all the cabins and cottages are now. Just above Miller Marsh's property, joined back in Hammonasset.
How many sawmills do you suppose there ever were in Madison at one time?
Well, there was that one there, and there was another one on the east side of the Hammonasset River at Duckhole.
Yeah.
Jim Walkley had the grist mill on the west side, and the sawmill was on the east side.
Exactly the same position, same opposite each other.
Yeah.
Right where the dam is now.
One was in Clinton, one was in Madison.
Yeah. That's where the dam used to be. But there were only two, as you know of, in Madison? Is that...
No, there was another mill, I don't remember it. It was fallen down before I got there, in the up at Ed Sherman's on the Green Hill Road. That was called a paper mill. And then there was another one up where Ralph Hill's camp is. They called that the upper paper mill. And Dad used to tell about somebody that wrote a letter to Madison to a man that he knew was in Madison, but he didn't know where. So he wrote it, John Jones, Madison, Connecticut, care of PM. The guy took it up to paper mill.
Paper mill. Postmaster instead of the postmaster, eh? I'll be done. Well, what made your father give up the paper mill, the mill?
Lack of water and poor health.
Which is more important?
Well, he worked when he shouldn't have, but you couldn't run that mill without water. He did buy a great, big, enormous gasoline engine. And from C.S. Marston Company in Ohio. And it was installed on the first day of January 1900.
Good. That's a good date to remember.
They got it up there the last day of December. It was an enormous big thing. The flywheels were as high as this mantle and that wide. And they got it set up, and Dad said to the fellow who was installing it, "You'll be up tomorrow and get it going." "No, sir." He said, "I'm not going to start a new century by working on New Year's Day." Well, Dad says, "Tomorrow isn't the first day of a new century." He says, "The first day of 1900. He said, "The first day of new century will be January 1st, 1901. They argued that all day. That's the first day of the last year.
Who run out?
In the 19th century. Well, Dad couldn't convince him. It's plain as the nose on your face.
But did they get operating eventually?
Oh, yes.
It worked?
Worked beautifully. We use
well, this replaced the water wheel, did it not?
It supplemented the water wheel. He used that for inside work. If he wanted to sell outside, he'd leave the pond to fill up and use the water power for the big saw. This was an enormous engine, but it probably wasn't any more powerful than a good 10 or 15 horse electric motor today. Just go and switch and you're running all day.
Yep. But he gave it up about shortly after 1900?
Oh, no. When did they... He had sold out to Arthur Scranton, and Arthur Scranton sold to Joe Schmidt purely for the ice business.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dad built a shop down here in the orchard, and that was where he made his spools to Anatoly Fund.
I never heard of that. He made spools, wooden spools, to wind gold leaf on. Amazing. Why, was there any demand for this?
Only man in the world that made them, and only one company that used them.
How long did that go on?
I can tell you about that, because I worked with him. You don't got that thing plugged in, have you?
Yeah, I haven't got it.
Have you?
I have. Go ahead, forget about it.
Well, the Walter H. Coe Company.
Walter H.
Walter H. Coe Company.
In relation to Pete, you see?
74 Wisconsin Street in Providence, Rhode Island. He was a Madison man who lived in the house next to Reynolds, Hobart Store, where Reynolds Liquor Store is.
Really?
And he developed this process of gilding flat surfaces. The gold leaf was wound on these little wooden spools and put in a handle and used just like a roller blotter that we used to have.
How wide were the spools?
They're 5 3/4 inches long, 3/4 inch in diameter, and had a hole bored through the center,
mm-hmm.
which was the axle.
Did it have a flange at either end? Or
some of them did and some of them didn't. To make them absolutely accurate and true, they were cut out of 1 1/4 white wood sticks and bored straight through from one end first, and then they were turned on plug centers so that they were absolutely the same distance from the center hole all the way. A lot of waste to it.
About the same as a lathe.
He had special lathes that turned them, sure. And I used to count them and pack them in barrels and ship them to Providence.
How many could they possibly use? I should think a couple of dozen a week would be
Oh, heavens. We used to ship out 5 or 6 flour barrels full at a time, or sugar barrels full.
Really? How did this gold man get all his gold, and how could he...
Well, he bought it. Didn't you ever read anything about beating gold leaf?
No.
Well, they could take an inch cube of gold and beat it out so fine that you could paper the walls and ceiling of a room 12 feet square and 8 feet high.
Oh, really?
The little pieces were so thin that a fly's wings would make them flutter. I have an article not long ago.
How do they beat it out?
They have a special kind of an anvil, and it is beaten out with wooden mallets inside of the lining of a cow's stomach. In between, I think, I hammered out. The little piece is hammered and hammered and hammered and hammered. And it keeps getting wider and wider. It's just like rolling out pie crust. The more you roll it, the further out it spreads. And the surfaces to be gilded were covered with a sticky substance.
Well, it wasn't a very difficult operation, was it, to make these wooden spools? I think there'd been an awful lot of competition.
Well, eventually there was. They got so much business finally. Ed ran out of material. He used native white wood.
Was that important? Why?
Had to be soft and easily turned and give a nice, smooth, very smooth finish. So then he started buying white pine, which was difficult to get and expensive if you got the good material. And then the demand was so great that he couldn't keep up with it. Cyrus Everts took it over for a while, and he made them, and then eventually he gave it up, and I don't know whatever happened after that.
I suppose this is an example of scores of industries, small industry, one-man operations that were done here in this little village.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe that the stories I've heard about the crayon factory and about the...
I worked for George Weld in the crayon factory.
Not really.
Les Chalk and his brother Bert and Dad's cousin Frank Whedon. And they made this crayon. It had to be just right. It was too brittle.
Where'd the chalk come from?
They bought a whiting.
Whiting is what? Kaolin?
Well, I don't know what whiting is, but it's what they made the chalk of.
Calcium carbonate or something like that? You don't know the chemical name.
It was a big mixture, like a big bread mixture, like you mix dough with. And it was put in there with a certain amount of glue and other ingredients and mixed up, and then it was taken out in wads and put into a machine, well, just like sausage stuffers.
Mm-hmm. And
the girls sat at these benches, and as the stuff squirted out, they had little sticks about 18 inches to 2 feet long with a hollow in it. And they would catch this chalk soft then in these trays and snip it off at the end and keep moving them along. Then they were piled up.
How long were these lengths? A foot?
About 18 inches.
But then that had to be broken off into smaller sections.
They were cut with a cutter and
after it dried up.
Template. They had a template went over them, and they took a little roller knife and went right across, and you cut eight or ten trays at once.
While they were dry or moist?
Soft. Then they were put on the trucks and pushed into a big kiln where they were baked. Then they were packed in these little boxes about 6 inches square with sawdust shaken in so they wouldn't break. And labeled, and the covers put on, and shipped away.
Did they make a living out of it? Did they make any profit?
George Well made good money out of it. Used to be George Munger's business originally on Wildwood Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
He sold out to George Well.
Do you remember exactly where that factory was?
Sure.
Where? On Wildwood Avenue?
On Wildwood Avenue, just around the corner back of Grace Hull's house.
Really? Close as that to the post road?
The land lay there with a fallen down building for years and was never sold because there wasn't any right of way to it. I think Jake Rickert bought it and sold it to somebody, and it is now in back of the house where Ward Munger Parker, Mr. John Parker, lived. That was George Munger's house.
How many other, could you make a list of the different industries that Madison activated and ran?
Only other one I can think of, when you were talking about that storehouse there that was out on the dam, that was piled full of oak sticks that my grandfather used to make wagon wheel spokes.
Really?
He didn't do anything about the hubs. The hubs were made of elm, and he didn't bother with that. But he made the hickory spokes, and they went to Guilford, to the Guilford carriage shop, where they made wagon wheels. The spokes were all turned in that same shop up there at Whedon's Pond.
How do you turn a spoke which is not round? It's an oval, isn't it?
Yeah.
Most wagon spokes have a...
Well, they worked out a template by hand, which was up in the top of the machine, and then the cutters that cut the thing were in another holder down below that, that followed along, and the top one was used as a guide. It was handwork, but